You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
It's this week. We are joined, as always, by our expert.
Not always, once again, fortnightly,
by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yeah.
It's a Tuesday.
Feels a bit strange that I'm always saying good afternoon 3 minutes past the hour.
But it is. You know, you can't argue with it.
Every week, I'm always bemused by the miracle of the wire showtime and how this works out. As I've been bemused, smooth segue here, by these whimsical stories of science that we've got going on here. Some a little bit less whimsical and perhaps more scary that we'll get to a bit later. But we'll start off with what you've got first here, which is the humans. This one was, I mean, quite remarkable when I was looking at it.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, this one's scary, I think. This is all about aging.
Yeah.
And, you know, contrary to what some people think, I haven't recently turned 70, but
no.
I did have a big birthday recently. And this was quite distressing to me, actually, when I read this particular article in The Guardian.
Mm.
So we normally think about aging as being a gradual process.
You start
off young, you move through your 20, 30, 40, blah, 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 blah. And it's a nice sort of linear thing.
And
you end up, you know, slowly getting your crow's feet and, you know, and getting a little bit stooped, all that sort of stuff. And But there's workers in the USA and Singapore who are giving the lie to this, basically. And what they have found from their studies is that there are spikes in aging. There are two big spikes in aging.
Mm.
Around the ages of 44 and 60.
Wow, that's not...
I know.
Yeah.
I know. So how did they come by this? Well, again, as is usual with these sorts of studies, they got a bunch of volunteers, and these volunteers were aged 25 to 75, and they looked at these folk over a time period of between 1 and 7 years. You know, this is long-term
stuff.
Quite
a big study, yeah.
And what did these volunteers do over periods of 1 to 7 years? Well, they gave blood and stool samples every few months. And they also gave skin, oral, and nasal swabs.
Oh, so again, big, lots of stuff going on there.
Yeah. So, you know, it's quite sort of intrusive or invasive or whatever. You know, it's not a simple thing,
over
really.
7 years as well, geez.
It is. And apparently the average time that people spent in the study was about 1.6 years or something like that.
So not so bad.
You'd had some that were really in it for the long haul.
Mm.
So of all of these samples, what they did was that they analysed them for, get this, 135,000 different molecules, which just blows my mind. You know, as a chemist, that's extraordinary. That's a heck of a lot of molecules. And the molecules they're looking at is RNA and proteins and metabolites.
Mm,
so
classic
metabolites being stuff. The products of particular sort of bodily functions and stuff. And they're also looking at microbes as well, the bugs, you know, in, on, and all around you sort of thing. And what they found was, well, they're looking at the general, at the abundance of these, basically, at the amounts of these, and how they changed over time. And what they found was that there wasn't a nice sort of gradual change in certainly some of these molecules. And again, what they came up with was, you know, around the ages of 44 and 60, there seemed to be big changes, big jumps or depletions or whatever in the amounts of some of these molecules.
Right.
And so that got them thinking.
Hmm.
And their first thought was, okay, well, 44, well, that's, you know, when some women start going through menopause.
Sense.
And so they thought, well, you know, that might be a reasonable explanation for that. But they did the sex analysis and they found that, you know, it didn't matter. Guys and girls, you know,
they both
had the spike at 44. And so, you know, that's a real thing, regardless of sex. And these first wave of changes at the age of 44, they involve molecules that were linked to things like cardiovascular disease.
Right.
And the ability to, funnily enough, metabolize things like caffeine and alcohol.
I mean, anecdotally, that makes a bit of sense, right?
Yeah. I would think so. You know, you're in your 40s. You can afford the good booze now. You know, so, and so you might have a little bit more of it and everything.
Mm.
And the second big spike at age of 60 was related to immune system regulation.
Again, yeah.
So again, probably not surprising. Their carbohydrate metabolism, so things like diabetes and stuff like that, very potentially, and also kidney function. Bit worrying.
Yeah, that's not so great.
And what they found was that so your normal signs of aging, your sort of skin, your wrinkles, your body getting a little bit more floppy, whatever. So your skin and your muscle aging was both observed at 44 and 60. Okay,
right.
So that was not peculiar to either. So it was there in both. So. Apparently, previous work had showed that there was also a spike at about the age of 78.
Wow.
That people go through
quite late. Yeah.
But they couldn't study that in this case because their cohort was between 25 and 75.
Right,
so
right.
they never quite got around to that. But this hadn't been seen before. And, you know, as one who's just turned one of those ages, I'm a bit...
I'm a bit concerned. Yeah.
So, you know, there's good reason to get out on the... track on a Saturday morning and go for a park run or something like that, I think. But,
yeah.
There's probably someone listening at the moment or potentially who is coming up on 44 or 60 and is potentially losing it right now, and I think that's a very funny mental image to be having someone sat in their car being like, oh, no.
If you are losing it right
stating
now.
Stating the facts, folks. Don't shoot the messenger.
Not a huge... Well, maybe a small worry, but not you shouldn't be too worried about it. But also, I was wondering, is this sort of a similar spike that you might see in terms of aging, like spiking at certain points? You might see it with young people, you know, going through puberty. Maybe you're aging faster at that point?
That's a very good question. Mm. And I think there'd be some probably ethical problems if you were going to look at children of that age going through these sorts of things. But again, no, I think that's an excellent point. And whether or not somebody's done that or they're going to do that, you know, it seems like something that's worthy of study. I'd say a
second sort of puberty. Also giving a little bit of academic backing to the midlife crisis, right? with putting it in a bit of a there's some proof behind that.
Fair point.
Of interesting stuff there. And then this one, a little bit terrifying. We were chatting about it during Roundup this morning. This poisonous dye in books.
Yeah, poisonous books. Who would have thunk it? I don't know. So, bit of background to this one. I don't know whether you know the story of good old Napoleon and supposedly how he might have died.
I'm not familiar.
So he was exiled to St. Helena.
Yes,
in the middle of the Atlantic.
I do know that bit.
And so he was in a house with green wallpaper, and the green wallpaper contained an arsenic compound.
Oh.
And so the theory apparently goes that there were some bugs there who could basically metabolize the arsenic in the wallpaper and turn it into a volatile gas that contains arsenic. He then inhaled that and it shortened his lifespan. And apparently they analyzed his hair after he died, and they did find sort of high levels of arsenic there that couldn't be explained. So, segueing into 19th century or Victorian era books with bright covers. And what had been found previously was that, yes, they used this similar pigment that was in Napoleon's wallpaper, this green pigment, had been used in book covers, okay? And it's a thing called copper acetoarsenite.
Right, arsenite being the
arsenic bit, the nasty bit, yeah. And so they knew that this had been used in book covers that were green, but there was lots of brightly coloured sort of yellow books covers and stuff like that. And they thought, oh, okay, well, let's have a look at these. What's that yellow pigment in these Victorian era books? And so a bunch of workers in the States decided to get into their library, basically, find all these lovely old
books.
Take
a little bit of a look.
And then let's do some high-level chemical analysis of these things and see what's in them. And so they used things like X-ray fluorescence, inductively coupled plasma, and X-ray diffraction.
Wow,
and these are just
lots of technical stuff.
It is, and you know, this is very sort of high-end analytical stuff. And what they found as a result of all this, they found that in the yellow books particularly, they would find high levels of lead and chromium. Neither of which is particularly good for your lead in all its facets, definitely not. Chromium, the jury's still out, but high oxidation state chromium is certainly not good for you.
Certainly not stuff you want to be sitting down and having a...
No, sniffing or eating or chewing or whatever. No, you don't want to be doing that. And so the fact they found both of those metals led them to think, okay, so the yellow color is lead chromate. And lead chromate is a very, very famous pigment and made famous by good old Vincent van Gogh with his sunflowers and everything like that. So Van Gogh's yellows were lead chromate. And now the chemical formula of lead chromate, here we go, hardcore chemistry here, PbCrO4, okay? So for every one lead, you've got one chromium, basically. That's what the formula is telling you. Now, when they did the analysis, they found that they had more lead than they did chromium. And so that led them, no pun intended.
Good one.
I'm on it. That led them to think that there had to be another source of lead in there in addition to just lead chromate. And so they're thinking now that there might be some lead oxide or some lead sulfide, both of which can be colored and, you know, contribute to the overall color of these things. Now, again, the dose makes the poison, I think, as was it Paracelsus once said, one of those old Greeks, Romans, whomever, and that's absolutely right. The dose does make the poison. So the mere fact that you're finding amounts of lead and chromium in there doesn't necessarily mean to say that they're going to be potentially nasty.
Right.
But they did quantify these amounts, and what they found was lead was present at twice sort of the recommended safe maximum amount.
Right.
And chromium was there at six times.
Yeah, so not so safe at all.
So who would have thought your library could be hazardous?
Yeah. It's
quite a bit of history of different pigments being poisonous, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Highly coloured things, they can and they can't be good for you. But again, you see in nature yourself, you know, lots of beautiful coloured flowers, and, you know, things
stay
like
away.
That. And so what they've now decided to do with these books is to keep them in plastic bags, which is probably sensible. I doubt that you're going to come to much harm or anything, because you would imagine that the lead and the chromium would be sort of essentially sort of locked up in the structure of the cover and stuff like that. So it's not going to be sort of freely available. It's certainly not volatile or anything like that. But I thought this was kind of fascinating. And, you know, possibly I think this might start a run of librarians rushing to check out their old book section, certainly Victorian or whatever era book section, and make sure that it's okay.
Yeah, terrifying stuff.
Yeah.
And then a little bit of an uplifting end note here. We've got water, uplifting the water perhaps, on Mars. This is, what have we got here?
Yeah, no, this is interesting stuff. Well, since the invention of the telescope by good old Galileo Galilei, one of the most obvious features of Mars through a telescope was the fact that it had canals, apparently, and that these canals were being used as, there must be intelligent life up there, because, you know, you couldn't make these canals, you know, without human intervention intelligent intervention. We now know that that's not the case, but we do know that the surface of Mars, you know, does look like it's got these sort of canal things and stuff like that. And in fact, these sorts of things on the surface are indicative of the fact that Mars did have water at one stage.
Right, that makes sense. Okay.
And so what, or you know, how did these channels and ripples come about? Well, they came about through the action of water, but then the next question, where did all the water go? Because, you know, we've been there's a little bit of water at the poles, you know, you see a little bit of ice at the poles.
Bit of ice, but mostly
and mostly
sand.
Just dust and all that sort of stuff. And they are thinking, you know, they're sort of dating this, that around about 3 billion years ago, Mars seemed to have lost all of its water. So there's a question, where did it all go? Did it just all go off into space? Because, you know, Mars has a very, you know, the atmosphere is much less on Mars than it is here.
And it can do that? Just water fly off?
Absolutely. You know, it can volatilize and away it goes at very, very low pressures. So,
incredible.
So we've had a NASA Mars InSight lander on there since 2018 on Mars. So this is one that's really sort of flown under the radar, so to speak. One of the less sexy probes, I guess, the less sexy Martian probes. And So it was designed to look at sort of the geology of Mars, in particular the presence or absence of earthquakes. So there's a seismometer on this little lander, and that measured the vibrations of the planet. And between 2018 and 2022, it measured a staggering 1,319 earthquakes.
Not so safe.
Which is, you know, pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Wellington, sort of. sort of situation.
Again, probably most of them just tiddlers, but...
Right.
So the important thing was that they would analyse these vibrations, essentially. And through an analysis of these seismic movements, they could figure out what the seismic waves were travelling through. So they could figure out whether they're travelling through rock or through clay or whatever, or even possibly water. Okay. And so they've released the results of all of this analysis now, and they say, yep, there is water on Mars. There's a lot of it, and it's at depths of between 10 and 20 kilometres.
Quite far down.
A wee way down. And so they're thinking that... basically, their analysis only applies to pretty much the ground directly under the lander.
Yeah.
But, you know, if they can then extrapolate and say, right, well, you know, this is indicative
generally
of the whole planet,
then
you've got a repository for where all that water went. It's now down underneath the surface at a depth of 10 to 20 kilometres. So that probably answers the question of where did the water go. And then your obvious question after that is, well, you know, when we colonize the planet, you know, is that going to be a viable source of water for us? Well, you've got sort of 10,000 meters to drill before you can answer that
quite
question.
Quite a lot of and drilling.
It is. But, you know, it's very, very interesting to know that it's there.
Yeah.
So we thought that the water might have gone up, but actually it's reverse.
Well, certainly some of it would have gone up, but there seems to be a big old chunk of it that's, you know, that's gone down. So interesting stuff there. Again, as usual, more research is needed.
Yeah, perhaps these ancient Martians, after building these canals...
You're onto it, exactly.
...built some sort of reservoir underground.
That is the simplest possible explanation, and they're all there. I like it.
It's perfect.
Occam's razor. Yep, love it.
All right. Thanks for coming in today, Alan. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.